Welcome back to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings on the industry you can regularly read over on The Wrap, and whose musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Monday, April 1st, 2024. Quick question, Drew. Do we have any thoughts on April Fool's Day?
I hate it all.
Thank you. The only good thing
to come out of this is that the Americana at brand memes account, which Jim, if you've ever, have you ever been to the Americana in Glendale?
Yeah.
Okay.
Little trolley rolling down the street. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Of course. So this is a meme account that is just about the Americana, which we love, but they switched over to a Universal Studios Hollywood account today, which has been absolutely delightful. My wife heard me on the toilet giggling because I was looking at these things. Yeah. Okay. That's the only good thing. But otherwise, it sucks. It absolutely sucks.
I have to admit, you know, it's the one day a year where painfully humorless people try to be funny and typically fail. So it's like, you know, leave being funny to the professionals like Mr. Taylor. Okay.
Now, that's right.
That said, though, I did do something foolish today, Drew. I went to Walmart and I bought the Blu-ray and the DVD version of both Disney Wish and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. And why this is foolish is Disney Wish debuts on Disney Plus in 2 days.
Foolish, Jim. This is that we need to maintain our physical media. There presence. We go. We have to stand strong. We have to be like Tracy Letts, and who has 10,000 DVDs. Mm-hmm. We have to make a stand. So I applaud you.
I'm fully on board with you know Guillermo's take on this, and that it's a Fahrenheit 451 level of responsibility. But that said, I am a cheapskate. I stood there looking at the $34 Walmart exclusive Steelbook version of Wish, and just I couldn't do it. I just could not buy that thing. Opted for the $24 version though. Though speaking of Spider-Man, did you see that short? Spider Within, the Spider-Verse story that Sony Pictures Animation pushed out on the 27th?
Oh, absolutely, Jim. I actually got a little preview of that before I left for Annecy last year. So I saw that and had a lovely chat with the filmmaker behind it, really sweet guy. And then I think it actually premiered at Annecy last year. So, yeah, I kept bugging our friends at Sony saying, when is this coming out? When is this coming out? Because I really enjoyed the short a lot, and I'm glad that it's finally out in the world.
Same thing here. Now, speaking of things that would have finally been out in the world, I mean, it's worth noting that Beyond the Spider-Verse, if it had stuck to the original schedule, would have actually been released in theaters this past Friday, March 29th. Got delayed back on July 28th, and we're still hearing 2026, yes?
I have not heard a date yet. It is getting very tricky because Phil and Chris are leaving for London soon to work on their new movie, Project Hail Mary, which is based on the book by Andy Weir. I don't know if you read that or not, Jim, but it is going to be a great, great film. Ryan Gosling is in that. So I don't know where they're at and how far along they are, but let's hope for the best, Jim.
Let's hope for the best. Okay, now, speaking of things that, and forgive me, folks, we're about to thread the needle here on the show. Things that Drew can't necessarily talk in great detail about, but this past week, you were up at Emeryville for the long lead press day for Inside Out 2, right?
Yes, absolutely. I had a great time up there. Very quick trip. Friend of the show, John, came up and had me sign his Art of Onward book, which was very sweet.
Cool. All right.
I got to sit down. And I sat down with our friend Bob Peterson, which was great. And at some point, Pete Sohn walked over and sat down with us and chatted for a little bit. So it was a lovely time. And I got to see some stuff from Inside Out, too. But I cannot talk about it, Jim. Don't get me in trouble with the Pixar gods.
Okay. Then we'll Okay. When the embargo lifts, we will have an in-depth look at the sequel, which is coming out on June 14th, right? In fact, yes. Though, worth noting, in fact, you were just talking about your wonderful Pixar Art of Onward book. Well, we're chasing down, but the folks at Chronicle reached out earlier this week, and it turns out The Art of Inside Out 2 will be hitting store shelves next month. In fact, literally 1 month out, May 2nd, 2024. And that's a full 6 weeks prior to the movie arriving in theaters on June 14th. So I'm going to have to really exercise some self-discipline there.
You know? I have my eye on you,
Jim. Okay, I'll behave. Okay. But again, speaking of books that Drew and I have been looking forward to for quite some time, Stephen Anderson's long in the works, Disney In Between, The Lost Years, 1966 to 1986. Just today, Dave Bossert reached out, and it turns out that his Old Mill Press is going to be publishing this 500-word book that, and by the way, it's going to ship in July.
I hope it's 500 pages and not 500 words, Jim, because I think...
I'm sorry. 500 yes. Pages. Yes. Sorry. Okay, my mistake.
You know what? I saw a post that Steven put up, I think, that said that it was Old Mill Press now, which obviously was very exciting. So we'll have to have Steven and Dave on the show.
That would be great. That would be great. That would be great. By the way, you can get a signed version of this book if you go to the Old Mill Press for just $39, which, by the way, is 13% off of its $45 list price. And while we're plugging away here, it's worth noting that friend of the show, Josh Gad, just became an author. Do you see this? His picture book, Picture Face Lizzie? Illustration by Marta Kissy. It's going to hit store shelves on September 17th of this year. It's from Putnam's Books for Young Readers Division, and I just ordered my copy of this 32-page hardcover earlier today. While I was doing that, Drew, I also ordered somebody else's book. Another thing we haven't been able to talk about on this show. So, how long have you been working on Art of Amphibia now?
I've been working on it for the past few months. I think I can say that. Okay. But it's been an absolute delight. And the book turned out super well.
Okay.
Working with Matt on this thing has just been a delight.
Matt Bradley, right? The Bradley, creator of Amphibia. Okay.
And it's basically like, if you're a fan of the book, if you're a fan of the show, this is the book that you want to get because it's just got so many great illustrations. And I talked to the various production designers and also kind of, Matt tells his story of the show and how it evolved each week and each season. And as a fan of Amphibia, it was everything that I wanted. It's a beautiful book that I just cannot recommend enough, not because of me, but because of all the amazing artists that contributed to it. And Jim, you know how rare it is to get an art of book from a TV show. I mean, it does not happen very often. So
No. It's so that again, 224 pages, folks, available for pre-order right now over on Amazon. In fact, you can get 10% off if you hop on the train now. But that hits store shelves on November 19th of this year. So
it's a perfect holiday gift, Jim. If you have a family member, a friend who loves Amphibia, just go out and get this book. Don't buy Josh's book. He's fine. He's got a... I saw he was conducting the Disneyland Railroad. I mean, he's fine. Listen, I'm out here on the streets. I'm out here just trying to make an honest buck. So, yeah. You know what? Okay, go buy both. How about that?
There we go. Yeah. Okay. So I know, folks. I know that's a lot of plugs at the start of the show. But hey, here's one more. The news portion of today's show is brought to you by TouringPlans.com. If you're headed down to Orlando anytime soon to visit some of the theme parks down there, touring plans can help you save time, more importantly, can help you save money. So before you book that trip to Central Florida, please go check out touringplans.com and you can thank us later. Okay, now to the news. Okay, Kung Fu Panda, third week in theaters. You know, this time around came in behind Kong Godzilla, The New Empire, Ghostbusters, The Frozen Empire, and Dune 2, but...
So many empires.
So many empires, yeah. Okay, but on the other hand, it's to date, it's made $151 million domestic, $195 million overseas, worldwide box office of $347. Worth pointing out here that, you know, it has already outgrossed domestically what Kung Fu Panda made back in 2016. That was $143 million for, and that was over 168 days out in theaters versus the $151 million that Kung Fu Panda 4 just made just over 24 days. So that bodes well box office wise.
Do you want to know something interesting about Kung Fu Panda and its director, Mike Mitchell?
Absolutely.
He is the only director in history to direct two films in franchises that have grossed over $2 billion.
Wow.
Because he made a Shrek, and now he's made a Kung Fu Panda. Both $2 billion franchises. So anyway, just a little interesting tidbit there.
Now, speaking of DreamWorks, wanted to get your thoughts on all of the concept art that was released just last week for How to Train Your Dragon Land at Epic Universe Park. That'll be opening in 2025.
Yeah, when in 2025, Jim? That's my question. I look at BioReconstruct's photos and I say, we can't have lunch breaks anymore. We got to get to work on this land.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the interesting thing is the hotels, at least the two moderates at sort of the entrance, you know, those will be taking bookings in, I want to say, January and February. So a lot of people are reading the tea leaves and suggesting that, well, the park will at least be in preview mode at that point. But as you mentioned, you know, when you look at BioReconstruct's flyovers, it's like, that's got a long way to go yet. But beyond that, seeing as much as you've seen of How to Train Your Dragon Land, are we getting on a plane or do we have any thoughts?
Oh, I'm ready, Jim. I'm ready to go to the Isle of Burke. I am ready. I think it looks beautiful. I love how much there is to do. Mm-hmm. There's like four separate experiences, right? Is that what they're calling it?
There we go.
Yeah, I thought it was just amazing. And I think, you know, I think it is not a coincidence that we are getting a live action How to Train Your Dragon around the same time as this land opens. Yeah, I'm just, I think it's fascinating how all in they are on this franchise. It's really...
Totally. And yeah. For me, you know, it's worth noting that 14 years ago this month, the art of How to Train Your Dragon was published by New Market Press. I know, another book plug, folks. But why I love this book is that it features the original take on Hiccup and Astrid back when, you know, there was a full year they were working on this movie where the kids literally were kids. They were 8 and 10 years old, which I guess is reflective of the Cressid Cowell books. But
yeah,
anyway.
I remember the movie was a big deal at the time because it was the first DreamWorks movie that actually had children as the main protagonists. Because all the other movies, they were adults. So I'm sure there was a lot of test and adjust with that. And I think they hit on the right time frame. Because they age, too, between each movie, right?
They did. Yeah. And I flat out love the first film in this series. The next two are good. I mean, and Hidden World especially has a wonderful ending. But you mentioned the live action film, which again, you know, what I love about that is Dean Dubois. And how long has Dean been trying to get a live action film, any live action film going?
Oh man. Well, Dean has sold like, I want to say like a half a dozen live action projects.
Yeah.
And he pitched a movie called Nightlights that was basically Stranger Things before Stranger Things. Like, the near misses he's had over the years are really staggering. I'm sure he was well compensated for sticking around the How to Train Your Dragon franchise, but yeah, I'm excited to see him do a live action movie. Do I wish he was doing an original movie? I do. Okay. This will be great. This will be great.
No, can't wait. Can't wait. Now, speaking of Toothless and the other dragons, that you know, those will be animated, and so live action and animated mix. But speaking of that, we got this week a Woody Woodpecker Goes to Camp trailer. This is dropping on Netflix on April 12th. Eric Baza is the voice of Woody, and we have Mary Louise Parker as sort of the live-action lead of this thing. But we also have Kevin Michael Richardson doing the voice of Buzz Buzzard, and Tom Kenny is Wally Walrus. And by the way, Mr. Baza, he did Woody Woodpecker for the Universal's Woody Woodpecker film back in 2017. So he's done this character for a while now. But he's also done a lot of the Looney Tune characters. Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Tweety, Marvin Marchin, also Buster Bunny for Tiny Toons, Looniversity. But again, just want to point out that Eric's my hero for having stood up at the Annie's this year and shouted from the stage, "Free Coyote and Acme." And there is no news, right, Drew? There's no news.
There is no news. The amount of people that came up to me at Pixar and were like, "What's going on with it?" You know, and I had to say, "I don't know. I think that it is gone. It was part of that write down from earlier this year, but." Yeah, no news so far. And in this case, Jim, no news is bad news. So.
Okay, now, speaking of trailers that have a lot of animation and live action, Harold and the Purple Crayon, based on the children's book released back in 1955. This is coming from Columbia Pictures, will be out in theaters August of this year. We've got Zachary Levi as a star, and I won't lie, I'm pulling for this because Carlos Sedana is the director who co-directed the first Ice Age movie with Chris Wedge, which was still one of my absolute favorite animated films, and then you know Carlos did you know how many movies for Ice Age for Blue Sky Studios? I mean, the Meltdown, Dawn of the Dinosaurs, the two Rio movies, and Ferdinand. I want to support this movie, but that's not a great trailer.
No, it's not a great trailer, and anything with Zachary Levi makes me afraid that it is subversively faith-based. So you know, I was a little nervous there. I'm happy that he made it, that he got a movie made. Yeah. But yeah, it looks a little iffy. Did you see that the Cat in the Hat they announced too with Alessandro Carloni directing, who was one of the mini directors on Me and My Shadow as well?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So.
Okay. Again, another one I want to work, but But at the same time, in fact, it's fascinating that just this past weekend, you know, Godzilla Kong, you know, the new Empire came out, and it has a ton of animation. And I have to ask, you know, within your circle, folks who are professional entertainment writers, something like this that is so much animation that does have a live action component. How do you guys talk about this? I mean, that's largely, it's an animated film, right? Or it's an effects extravaganza. I mean,
yeah. I mean, the talking points always come from the studio. Mm-hmm. So Sony is very adamant that this is a live action feature with animated effects. And even Disney, you know, on the 2019 Lion King, which is quite obviously an animated movie.
Yeah.
They insisted that it was, you know, quote unquote live action, which just does not make any sense. So, yeah.
It's just hard for me to look at something like that when it's, you know, I would bet you that if you tote up the number of scenes in, you know, Godzilla Kong, the New Empire that are completely animated.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are animated features that are shorter than that.
Yeah. There's actually a percentage of runtime that is animated. That is how the Academy qualifies it. But again, it's the studio submitting the movie. So if Warner Brothers is not going to submit Godzilla Kong, then it's not going to be in the running. So I don't know. It's all about optics. And yeah, I don't know what the answer is, okay. Jim, but you're right. Okay. Yeah.
And well, speaking of optics, you know, wonderful stuff to look at. The folks at Disney Theatrical this past week released a whole bunch of video that had been taken at the New Amsterdam Theater on Thursday, March 28th, which is when Disney's Aladdin celebrated its 10th year on Broadway. And, you know, and what was kind of interesting is Casey Nicholaw, that they wanted this performance to be special. And so what they did is they presented the show as it's always been presented, but created these vignettes that, you know, supposedly fit in naturally with the show, where members of the original cast, like Adam Jacobs, who played, you know, originally played Aladdin, Courtney Reed, who played Jasmine, and Jonathan Freeman, who, again, did the voice of Jafar for the original movie in 92 and then was in the show on Broadway as Jafar, I want to say, for 8 years of the run. I mean, he hung in there forever. And of course, James Monroe Englehart also, he's the guy who took home the Tony for playing the genie. He came back and was part of the show that night.
And you didn't go, Jim?
It meant getting in the car and driving. And, you know, and this was also when we had our spectacular power failure here. We were without power, for 3.5 days. Just, again, I should have gone, didn't go. I'm a bad person. But on the other hand, you know, locally, I can go to Moana Jr. Did you know there is a stage version of, it's 60 minutes long, that Disney, in fact, it's the folks who do the Broadway shows on Disney who created these for elementary school and junior highs. And it is this crazy lucrative aspect of Disney Theatrical, that the number of schools that pay to, you know, present shows like Moana, or for that matter, Frozen. Interesting thing, Moana has not made it to Broadway officially yet, but there's Moana Jr. that plays everywhere. And from what I've heard, you know, after Moana 2 arrives in theaters this November, and whenever the live action Moana, you know, with Dwayne Johnson finally makes it into theaters, that they're supposedly going to take a look at maybe doing a Moana stage show.
Wasn't Newsies sort of mounted for?
Yes. Okay. That's it exactly. In fact, Disney was frustrated that they weren't making money off of the illegitimate Newsies shows that were being staged in high schools and at colleges, and so they deliberately created the version that wound up on Broadway. And in fact, I remember, I'm not going to share the name of the head of publicity at Disney, the PR, who shared this story with me. But again, the idea that they were only going to do a production at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey, so that they'd establish that, okay, you know, this is what the professional stage version is like. But it got such great reviews that, you know, it's like, well, now you got to take it to New York. And it's like, all right, well, we'll take it to New York, but just for 10 weeks. And then it, you know, it opens up Broadway, and I'm literally in there in the lobby of the theater when he gets the review in the New York Times, and it's a rave. And the head of PR for Disney Theatrical was like, oh, God damn it, now it's going to run. You know, and it did. It ran for like 2.5-3 years.
Yeah.
So
I saw it in previews on Broadway, and I thought it was a lot of fun. Look, didn't Harvey Fierstein wrote the book?
He did. Right? He did. Yeah. You know, but now, speaking of Disney on Broadway, did you get to see The Little Mermaid when it was there in town from January of 2008 through 2009?
No, I missed it. I was scarred from seeing Tarzan, I think. Because that show was absolutely terrible.
they didn't do what they were supposed to. It was designed to be a Cirque du Soleil show that you know was supposed to travel in a tent, you know, it wasn't supposed to be done in a theater with a balcony that over, you know, hung over the audience and blocked the view. But anyway, speaking of The Little Mermaid, okay, so that it only ran, the Broadway show only ran 685 performances versus the over 3,500 Aladdin has racked up today. And obviously, last summer's Mermaid movie was not the huge hit that Disney hoped. But this past Friday, which by the way, International Mermaid Day, we got a teaser trailer released for Disney Junior's Ariel, which is based on the Halle Bailey take on The Little Mermaid.
Well, it is and it isn't. It seems like an interesting fusion of both the classic 89 movie and the Halle Bailey character, because Sebastian and Flounder seem very similar, right? But then there's like a completely different Ursula, which is sort of weird. I don't know. That trailer was kind of weird. I mean, I know I'm not 2 years old, but...
Yeah. No, I think you're not wrong there. I think, you know, that there's enough of a nod to the original animated feature from 89. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that connects. And speaking of different takes on characters, Popeye, which we talked about in a recent fine-tuning here, there's more to that story, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, this... And we're back. Before we get started here, another trailer just debuted. And this is, it's a sequel of sorts to the Camp Cretaceous series for Netflix, right?
Yeah, I think you and I both thought that Camp Cretaceous had run its course. Mm-hmm. But no, there is a new series produced by DreamWorks and Amblin. Mm-hmm. And... it's, you know, they're off the island, but they're kind of getting hunted down one by one. It looks really interesting, and I think they've done a lot of really fun stuff in that animated space, because the shows are not like kiddie.
Oh no, no, no!
Like
no.
there's an edge to them, and so it looks really fun. It's called Chaos Theory.
Well, and what's fascinating about this is if you've paid attention to the Universal project that's being built in Bliss, Texas, the Universal Kids Park that's, you know, sort of that, you know, in that Peppa Pig Legoland space. There is a Camp Cretaceous land going into that park. And you got to wonder, you know, is this one of the things behind Chaos Theory? The notion of keep that franchise alive so when this park opens, it's like, oh, well, you want to meet the Camp Cretaceous characters, you got to go to Bliss, Texas. So
yeah, and I wonder how it's going to feed into this new Jurassic Park movie that is coming next year from David Koepp and Gareth Edwards.
Yeah.
You know,
I've been kind of interested, you know, who did they announce just last week about casting on that?
Scarlett Johansson. And Jim, that's just the beginning. There's going to be another big,
really
big name announced soon.
Yes. Okay. Yes. All right. Well, okay. Then we'll keep an eye on that. All right. Anyway, on last week's fine-tuning, we used the new live-action Popeye movie that's in development. It was an excuse to revisit Gennady Tartakovsky's animated Popeye, which was supposed to be the celebration of the Fleischer shorts. And, you know, just kind of broke my heart that it didn't go forward. But anyway, as part of that feature, we talked about that weird moment in the 1960s when Popeye's foil's name changed from Bluto to Brutus. And now, you just talked about, Drew, friend of the show, BioReconstruct, reached out to say, now hang on, you know, at some point, the guy who beat up Popeye did get his name changed back to Bluto, and he offered up as proof a photo of the marquee for Popeye and Bluto's Bilge Rat Barge, the ride at Universal Islands Adventure. And so that got me wondering, what happened here? So I did some more research, and it's kind of this fascinating look at animation from the 60s to the 80s. And for starters, again, it's the early days of television, and Paramount turns around and it sells the TV broadcast rights to the Popeye shorts, the ones that were created at Fleischer Studios, the ones that were created at Famous Studios, and to various markets around the U.S. And they're hugely successful. And more to the point, there's this enormous appetite for what else you got that's Popeye related. But here's the thing. King Features Syndicate, the folks behind the Popeye comic strip, the one that runs the newspapers, as well as the Popeye comic books that you could buy at newsstands or that sort of thing, they noticed that there's this appetite out there. But here's also the other thing they noticed. They didn't get any money when Paramount sold the rights, the broadcast rights to these shorts. And so it's like, well, I think it's time we got into the animation business. So they form King Features Animation. And what they do is they put the Popeye the Sailor series into production. And between 1960 and 19...
What year is this? Oh, okay.
You're going to tell us right now. Okay. Starts in 1960, runs through 1963. And what's interesting is they reach out to the performers who did the voices for the Paramount or the Fleischer shows and the Famous shows, Jack Mercer, Mae Questel, and Jackson Beck, but here's the kicker: somewhere along the line, wires get crossed at King Features, and somebody decides that, oh my God, we don't actually own the rights to Bluto. That somehow. And the weird part of it is, if they'd gone back into their own archive, Bluto was a character that literally came straight out of the Thimble Theater comic strip. But executives at King Feature Animation Studios got frightened, and so they created this lookalike character called Brutus, and you know, brought him in to serve as the villain. And mind you, to make sure that you know that fans of the TV show wouldn't get confused, they actually bring Brutus into not only the newspaper strip but also the comic book. You know, and they introduce him as Bluto's brother.
So they can mention him, they just couldn't show him. Or at least that was...
Well, yeah!
That was the legally acceptable... Within the bounds of legally acceptable behavior, I guess, right?
Yeah, now, but where this gets genuinely strange is that the Fleischer shorts... you know, and the show is the Popeye the Sailor show that the King Features Animation does... is serviceable. I mean, it's suitable for, you know, a Saturday morning, kids sitting in front of the television, eating a bowl of cereal, but it's not great art. But on the other hand, the Fleischer shorts are beloved. And, you know, starting into the 60s and going into the 70s with the rise of animation festivals and that sort of thing, there are literally theaters around the United States, repertory theaters, that would put together an entire evening of Popeye shorts. And you could go and watch these amazing Max Fleischer shorts. And so now it's the public that sort of, well, you know, look, Popeye doesn't fight Brutus. Popeye fights Bluto. And so now we jump ahead to 1978, and there's a brand new, you know, in fact, it's Hanna-Barbera reaches out to King's Features, and it's like, hey, you know, let's bring Popeye back, you know, and let's do it right this time. We'll have him, interacting with Bluto. We'll do it right this time. But, Drew, you're going to love this. This is when... You know, the show gets underway in 1978, but this is when the restrictions on violence in children's television were underway. So now it's a Popeye cartoon, and it, you know, he eats the spinach, and, you know, plays, but they don't fight. They weren't allowed in that era of, you know, children's television. Popeye couldn't punch Bluto. He could lift him up. He could throw him, but, you know, and he could use like a front loader or a bulldozer to move Bluto along, but he could never hit him. So those are out there. That actually runs for three seasons on Saturday morning on CBS. And Meanwhile, in the middle there, December of 1980, we get our Popeye live action movie. And sometime after that, we get the Muppet Babies debuting in 1984. And suddenly, everybody's got to be a baby, or everybody's got to have a kid. And so now we get Popeye and Son, the show that debuts in September of 1987. And you would have been watching television at this point, right? Or
I don't remember this. Yes, I was sentient, okay, but I do not remember.
All right.
Popeye and Son. But I mean, I appreciate the family dynamic. I'm glad that, you know, did the little son have a tattoo as well? I mean,
first of all, again, it was Popeye and Olive Oil. They're the ones who had Popeye Jr., or typically on the show, they just called him Jr. Interesting thing, he hated spinach. In fact, he preferred hamburgers. He'd hang out with Wimpy. But, you know, he would, if trouble arose, he would force himself and choke down some spinach. And Bluto was also part of this. He had a son called Tank. And again, Bluto and Popeye had a rivalry, but they couldn't fight because that was children's television for that age. And what fascinates me is that, you know, both of these shows, actually all three of these shows, the Popeye the Sailor thing from the 60s, the all-new Popeye show from Hanna-Barbera in the 70s, and then this Popeye and Son, they've faded, you know, whereas, you know, faded and forgotten, where the Fleischer stuff, even today, you know, holds up so beautifully, you know, that they're just ridiculously entertaining. And speaking of something that's ridiculously entertaining, folks, if you are not listening to Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, which Drew does with his equally talented co-host, Charles Hood, you are missing out on so many great behind the scenes, you know, in film and television production stories. You know, the people you gotten to talk with over the years. And in fact, that's what's kind of fun about what's going on with your podcast right now, is because you're revisiting a lot of your earlier episodes, right?
Yeah, we are. We're releasing new episodes every Friday. And then on the main show, we're right in the middle of this mini series that we're calling The Directors, where we're talking to famous filmmakers who have made iconic Paramount films. So we talked to people like Penelope Spheeris from Wayne's World. She was absolutely amazing. And we're talking to the Zazz team and Alexander Payne and all of these awesome people about the movies that sort of were foundational to them, but also foundational to kind of the ongoing legacy of Paramount. And it's really been a lot of fun, and I hope people are enjoying it. So yeah, check that out.
Okay. And speaking of things we'd like you to check out, we do have some other podcasts here at Jim Hill Media. We've got, of course, Disney Dish that I do with Len Testa. We also have Looking at Lucasfilm I do with Brian Gahn. Likewise, we've got the Epic Universe podcast that I do with Eric Hersey, who handles the editing here now. And I also do with his lovely bride the I Want That Too show, where we talk about Disney merch. In fact, we just did record a show early this week where we are talking about the Enchanted Tiki Room Under New Management show, which, again, still has my favorite.
What the hell does that have to do with, is that on the I Want That show?
That is on the I Want That show, because
okay, was there merchandise for that?
Well, what's interesting is that Disney has just released, for the 30th anniversary of Lion King, there's a Zazzoo shoulder plush, you know, and this is now a thing. They did the Chubby shoulder plush just recently out on the West Coast for Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. So we used this plush, the Zazzoo plush to sort of, you know, and backfill on, well, he was one of the co-hosts of you know, under new management. And again, any excuse to share my favorite mean joke at a Disney theme park attraction, I take. You know, I'm exhausted. I think I'm going to go next door to the Hall of Presidents and take a nap. That was great stuff. And I'm not going to listen to anybody who says otherwise. Anyway,
Sounds pretty flimsy, but we'll allow it. We'll allow it.
Thank you. also, want to make sure remind you folks about our Patreon project, Disney Unpacked. We're coming up on the debut of our April show, which is about Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger Spin and how that interactive ride-through shooter got developed by Imagineering. And let's see, beyond that, I think this is where we talk about social media. Drew, where are you these days?
Well, I have a question for you first, mm-hmm. Jim. When you rode Buzz Lightyear for the first time in Florida, if you had wings, and it was the same layout and everything, and you thought, oh, this is cute, did you ever think it would become a staple of Disney parks around the world?
I won't lie. I did not. You know, I mean, it was one of these things where it was like, this is an interesting reimagining, you know?
Yeah.
You're not wrong.
Fit in the space.
I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, just keep the same physical plant in place. And but at the same time, remember, this is 1998, you know, and Toy Story had come out in 1995. And at that point, we knew there was going to be a Toy Story 2. Nobody had any idea that, almost 30 years now, and, Toy Story,